This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Bloomington Normal LGBTQ plus community gathers to remember those lost 1 year ago in a terrorist attack and hate crime in Orlando.
In some ways, it's not a perfect comparison, but in some ways, that was our community's 9/11.
David Bentlund says the Prairie Pride Coalition and Not In Our Town is honoring those who died with action, rolling out a new gay-friendly business directory. Illinois courts have weighed in on which state of Illinois bills must be paid first, and now the state is running out of money to pay those bills. The IPR Politics Roundtable has more. And John Norton talks with country folk rocker Robert Earl Keen, playing the Castle Theater Thursday night. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's June 12th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A year after a horrific mass shooting at a gay nightclub in Orlando, the local LGBTQ plus community is working to honor those who died with action. The Prairie Pride Coalition will observe the anniversary of the June 12th attack last year with a downtown Bloomington event tonight and the release of a directory of LGBTQ-friendly businesses and services. Martin Ross is with Not In Our Town. David Bentlund is the president of the Prairie Pride Coalition board and says the directory is a way to honor with action those who died a year ago.
You know, by most accounts, 2016 was a pretty crummy year on a lot of levels. But I think it particularly was hard on the LGBTQI plus community in that we had this terrible tragedy in June of 2016 where 49 LGBTQI plus members were lost in a shooting, which was one of the worst shootings in our nation's history. And that really, in some ways, it's not a perfect comparison, but in some ways that was our community's 9/11. It came at a time when we thought that we had achieved a lot of rights, which we did, freedom to marry, the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a lot of advances in our community. But at the same time, that one incident was sort of an eye-opener that made us realize that we're not quite as safe as we thought we were, and that there's always going to be discrimination and hatred and violence against our community, and that we need to respond.
So how fragile are those rights, do you think?
They're more fragile than I would like, most definitely. The present administration has said that they are not going to try to roll back rights that have been won over the years during the Obama administration. But at the same time, the administration also has the power to appoint judges and Supreme Court justices who may not be as kind and forgiving of LGBTQ equality, and that is what concerns us.
LGBTQ people work and shop in this community. I assume you had a pretty good idea about who might end up in this directory. How did it come about? And that's a question for both you and Martin.
Sure.
And Dave, why don't you take it first?
Okay. After last year's march, we had a march following the Orlando shootings, and we had nearly 300 people there. And, you know, we as a board, the Prairie Pride Coalition board, we talked about it, and we were happy with the results and the turnout of the march, but we wanted something that was longer lasting. We wanted something that that would have a lasting effect on our community and that wouldn't just be a sad occasion, but would be an opportunity for us to lift up the people in our community, the businesses and organizations in our community that are supportive. And so we really wanted to find a way to do that and to increase the visibility and awareness in our community as well. And we thought that this directory would be a good way to do that.
Martin, you're nodding your head. What would you like to add?
Just to emphasize what Dave was saying, for the last 2.5 years, I've volunteered. I've worked with Not In Our Town, Bloomington Normal, which is committed to fighting bigotry and bullying in the community, making it a stronger community. And our mission statement is to make this community a safe community, to make it a secure community. And that goes beyond just government, legal discrimination, that goes to the social paradigm, that goes to the emotional feeling of comfort in a community where you know where you can go to not be ostracized, to not be exposed to bigotry, racism, potentially violence. We're seeing that now.
How was the business directory promoted to the businesses? How did they find out about it? How did you recruit those businesses, David?
Well, we started with a Facebook post. We broadcast it pretty widely on Facebook, and we directed people to a link, which was an online registration where they could take a pledge that their business organization or service provider would be a welcoming place and would agree to display a decal that would identify them as such, because we thought that was important. We also sent direct emails to a lot of businesses and organizations that we felt strongly would sign on to this. So we did start with a pretty good database of people that we thought would be agreeable to being a part of this directory.
Any pushback? Anybody in the community say, no way do I want a part of this?
None at all. None at all. We've had a great turnout, and it's been a positive experience.
What do you think that says about Bloomington Normal?
It says that we can no longer call Bloomington Normal a conservative community and just leave it at that. I think that there are certain issues where this is a conservative community, but I believe on social issues that more and more this is becoming a progressive community where people have a live and let live attitude. They want to see people treated fairly and justly. And I think that's one reason why we haven't gotten any pushback on this project.
And that's right and not in our town's wheelhouse, Martin. What do you think about the statement that it says about this community, that there wasn't a lot of pushback or concern about an LGBTQ business directory?
It's very encouraging. I'm impressed every day in most ways with Bloomington Normal. The fact that both mayors have introductory pieces in this directory. It's a firm position that a lot of politicians, a lot of elected officials might be afraid to make, and they've been unequivocal in their support. And I think that's a very encouraging sign every day, and not just the LGBTQIA community, but many communities in town that I can see the evidence they're feeling safer. They know this is their community, and they're not going to be told it's not.
But as David said, it's fragile.
It is fragile.
One event could turn things around.
Exactly. And there was I'm not going to get into politics, but there was a recent event that could have went either way. And it didn't. And to me, that said a lot about where this community's head is at and the fact that you don't want to say there's more of us than them. But the fact is we have more of a community consensus that rights are inviolate, that they belong to us all, and we shouldn't stand in the way of those.
David, this isn't the first time the Prairie Pride Coalition has created something like this. Tell me about the wedding guide, and is all of that folded into this directory now?
Right, a lot of it is. Back in 2014, the state of Illinois passed a law which granted marriage equality to same-sex couples. And what we heard pretty immediately was that the couples were thrilled at that new law, but at the same time, they were apprehensive about what businesses they could go to. For instance, would this bakery accept them, accept their order for a wedding cake if there were two men on the top of the cake instead of a man and a woman? So there were lots of questions like that, and we even attended a local bridal fair that year, and there was very little there that was inclusive of the LGBTQ community. So this is why we created the wedding guide, so that we could reach out to some of these businesses and get an affirmation from them that they would serve our community with this new law and that they would be accepting of same-sex couples who were coming to them.
When you put it in those terms, it really sounds silly that a bakery might object to baking a cake that has two men on the top instead of a man and a woman.
It does. And, you know, we've heard cases of bakeries that have had problems with this, but the bottom line is business, and we would hope that they would accept our business and welcome us.
And Martin?
Dave's raised some interesting points. And one area that needs a lot of work in both in the Twin Cities and otherwise is, unfortunately, a lot of the faith community. And one thing I want to highlight is that the directory includes not only commercial resources, social agencies, etc., but Dave made sure to include those faith communities, those churches in town that are accepting of the community on its own terms, that aren't looking to ostracize, that aren't looking for people to hide who they are or what they want out of life or who they want to love, but that are accepting. And I think that's important, especially for students, for new residents.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy talking with the Prairie Pride Coalition's David Bentlin and Martin Ross with Not In Our Town. Martin, you helped with some of the logistics in preparing this guide. What was Not In Our Town's role in helping with this guide?
Well, Kelly Becker, she recently left for a post in Oklahoma. But she was the associate minister at First Christian Church, and she and our minister, it's my church, Jim Warren, were instrumental in establishing a one-and-all service that welcomed the community, that welcomed single parents, that welcomed anyone who might be having trouble finding a comfortable place of worship where they can share fellowship. And so Kelly helped us do some of the early discussions and planning, and then I kind of brought in my past graphic production experience I was with IAA for 24 years. And so basically it all just, and then Dave's knowledge of the community, what they wanted, his vision of making this happen, it all just kind of melded together. So basically at this point, Not In Our Town, Bloomington Normal will be... Oh, and I didn't mention Kelly was the co-chair of our Faith and Outreach Committee on Not In Our Town. Not In Our Town has pledged to support and where it can promote the directory.
What message, Martin, do you think the Rainbow Decal sends to residents and visitors to the community?
Well, Dave might better be able to answer this, but to my mind, it's an instant recognition factor. It's a symbol that says, you're welcome here. You're a valued customer. You come in here, and we'll treat you right. And Dave probably has some better thoughts on that.
There's a message to the straight community as well.
There is. I mean, I think that the overall message to this is that we are not a homogenous community, Bloomington Normal, that we are made up of many minority communities. And I think I mentioned this to you earlier, Mike, that that our minority community, the LGBTQI+ community, is sort of an invisible community in a lot of ways. And it's easy to forget that we exist here in Bloomington Normal, that we pay taxes and all those fun things that everybody else does. But I think that the presence of these decals around the community give an assurance that, you know, even if you're not a member of the LGBTQI+ community, that you are living in a community that is progressive, that is welcoming. And if you have relatives who come to this community, if you have friends who come to this community to visit, that they will feel welcome, that they will feel a part of this community.
The decals aren't out there yet.
No, they're not.
What's it going to feel like when you walk into a business and you open that door and you're surprised? You had forgotten or weren't even aware that particular business was in the directory, and you see that rainbow decal as a member of the LGBTQ community.
You know, in these times, it'll be a feeling of reassurance, just a feeling of an extra bit of support in times when we've begun to question how much support we have on federal and state levels. So it's and I think that this kind of goes back to our point that, you know, we've relied on government for a lot of the advances that we've made over the years. The legal opinions, the laws that have been passed, they've all been great. But at the end of the day, we have to change hearts and minds. And a project like this goes a long way toward introducing that concept in the community.
Martin?
And I was just going to add one thing. Working with agriculture, working with farmers for 27 years, the one thing that stands out to me about this as well is that this is just smart business as well as being the right thing to do. You never go wrong expanding your customer base, letting the customer know that they're always of value when they walk into your place.
And let's pursue that a little bit, Dave. What do you think this project might say about the buying power of the LGBT community? Do you want people who are gay or lesbian or questioning or any one of those letters that describes the community to actually say to the business owner, you know, thank you for having this decal. Thank you for making Bloomington Normal a more welcoming place.
Right. It'll be interesting to see what the responses are. I mean, you know, there's some members of our community who are still not completely out. So, you know, they may visit these businesses and be, you know, be very grateful and express that. Others might not feel as comfortable mentioning it, but at the same time will still be grateful that they know that there's businesses here in town that are supportive of them. But I, you know, it'll be hard to quantify, but at the same time, I think that the overall feeling will be very positive.
There are hard copies of the directory. Also, it's online. What went into that?
Yes. Well, the online version, I think, is sort of a work in progress at this point. I think what we'll do for starters is to put a PDF of the directory on our website, and then maybe later on we'll develop a separate web page that has more, sort of a searchable database of the businesses, so it'll be a little more complex.
And tell me about the event at the Bistro tonight in downtown Bloomington.
The event is a one-year remembrance of the Orlando shootings, which happened on June 12th of 2016, and we are going to take that time from 5 to 7 o'clock to just to get together as a community and to remember those souls who were lost a year ago, and then also to hear from some of our local activists. Both of the mayors have been invited, and I believe that both of them are planning to be there, and then also to roll out this program formally, because the theme of this year's events is Honor Them with Action. And it seemed to us that this project that we've been working on, this directory, dovetailed very nicely with that theme, and we thought that this was the perfect time to roll that out.
Okay, David Bentland with the Prairie Pride Coalition and Martin Ross with Not in Our Town, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thank you.
It was 1 year ago today, 29-year-old Omar Mateen killed 49 people and wounded 58 others in a terrorist attack and hate crime inside Pulse, a gay nightclub in Orlando. Tonight's observance and release of the business directory begins at 5 p.m. at the Bistro in downtown Bloomington. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Grinnell Mutual, offering auto, home, farm, and business insurance products for over 100 years to help people protect what's important today and into the future. Trust in tomorrow. More information at grinnellmutual.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up, John Norton talks with Robert Earl Keane, who plays the Castle Theater on Thursday. I'm Mike McCurdy at Sound Ideas. Illinois is very close to not being able to pay the bills the courts have ordered be paid first. That's the subject of this week's Illinois Public Radio's Politics Roundtable. IPR Sean Crawford moderates the discussion of that uncomfortable truth. The panel includes Charlie Wheeler, the head of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois at Springfield, Greg Hines of Crane's Chicago's Business, and IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey. Mackey starts by assessing a federal court ruling that indicates Medicaid providers should also be paid promptly, something that has not been happening.
The judge basically says that Illinois is not paying its Medicaid providers fast enough, which violates a court decree. They are being paid during the impasse. There was a consent decree dating back to the 1990s because Illinois wasn't doing a good enough job of fulfilling its obligations for people back then. And so even though the state is paying these, it's doing so after it's paying state employee paychecks. It's doing it after it makes its pension payments, after it repays bondholders. And there's just not enough money coming in to satisfy all these demands. And so Medicaid providers are in some cases six months, I believe, behind. And they want that sped up. The judge did not order the checks to be cut immediately or anything like that, which could have precipitated an immediate crisis in government beyond the one we already have. But she did give the state and the Medicaid organizations, the companies that are providing these services, just, I think, until June 20th to come up with some kind of agreement or solution.
And Greg, there was no clarity as far as what might happen on June 20th, or do we have a better idea of that?
No, the judge indicated that she wants a solution. She wants something that gives some relief to those who filed suit. And I don't blame them. If I were owed money for 6 months and was trying to operate a social service agency, I'd be a little ticked off too. The problem is there's not enough money. We're in a hole as a state, and we're getting hundreds of millions of dollars further in the hole every single month now. So until they work this out, it's going to be harder and harder and harder to pay the bills. Susana Mendoza, the controller, says she feels like a triage surgeon, and she's right. She's got to decide whether you're going to provide blood, in this case, to the right arm and the left leg. I mean, at a certain point, it just falls apart.
And Greg, can you explain why the judge would have this authority to say to the state of Illinois, put these bills higher than some other bills?
Medicaid is half the money comes from the federal government, so there's jurisdiction in the federal courts. In addition, there's civil rights questions that cover this. There's an argument here that the people were being mistreated here, mostly poor and minority. And beyond that, there have been past court cases and past agreements. So it's kind of you have a trifecta here. There's all kinds of reasons the federal courts can get involved.
Charlie, there's been more action happening in the courts, it seems, over the last couple of years than there has been at the state house itself, and this just goes right to that point.
Yeah, the state is operating on what we've called autopilot, and we're spending money to the neighborhood of $5, $6 billion more than we have coming in. And this particular case that the judge was dealing with was roughly $2 billion owed mostly to managed care companies that basically pay the doctors and the nurses and the people who treat low-income and senior citizens and people with disabilities. And the problem is that the providers, the doctors, are starting to not see Medicaid patients anymore. Or they're telling these folks, well, I'll treat you, but you have to pay up front because I can't wait to be paid by the managed care company who's waiting to be paid by the state. And so there's a real concern that folks are going to lose their ability to access medical care. And that's one of the things that I think is probably going through the judge's mind. If this were the matter of some multi-billion dollar corporation that's going to have to wait a little bit, the judge probably would have said, take a walk. But because of the impact on real live human beings among the people who are on the margins of society, she's basically going to tell the state, look, you have to give them the same kind of precedence, the same kind of concern that you do to paying state workers' salaries.
And speaking of state workers' salaries, I guess that's one of those things some people have talked about could be impacted if the state has to push a lot of Medicaid payments up front. They may not have enough money to make the payroll. There has been some talk of that. Do we have any idea if it could come to that?
Well, the controller says that's exactly the problem. So that the payroll is going out because of a state judge, or I should say a county judge, really, in St. Clair County's orders. That case is being appealed through the system. There's an appellate court argument coming up on that. But so then the controller is going to have to decide, okay, do I violate the federal judge's orders on Medicaid? Do I violate the state judge's orders on employee payroll? Do I violate my constitutional obligation to make the pension payments? Do I violate statutory and constitutional obligations to make these bond payments? And she's going to be, and I think the federal judge called it an unenviable position to have to decide what to do there.
And you talked to Susana Mendoza, and I thought she had this very interesting quote in that interview in which she said, I shouldn't have this much power.
Right. That's exactly it. She says, you know, if the General Assembly and the governor had actually done their jobs and passed a budget, she wouldn't be in this position to decide the winners and losers. And, you know, what she ends up doing is people come to her and say, OK, we run this social service agency. We're going to be, you know, we have to close because we can't even make payroll for the next month. She can try and expedite that payment. But that's about the extent of what she can do without a real budget. She made the point, you know, you look at her website, there's every day it shows the amount of money that comes into the general fund and how much is spent. The bill backlog is over 14, almost approaching $15 billion. And on the most recent day, they spent about $14 million. So just a tiny fraction of the money that the state of Illinois is already obligated to spend.
Yeah. And I think I'd like to interject here. We keep talking about, oh, we need a budget. That kind of glosses over the reality of the situation. A budget basically is authority to spend money, an appropriation bill. It tells some agency, some entity, you can spend up to this much from this fund for this purpose. And you could have all the appropriation authority you wanted, but if there's no money there, it doesn't do any good. That's why the schools are waiting for their categorical grant payments to the tune of, what, $1 billion or so. What you need is the revenue. You need to raise more revenue. You need to raise taxes. That's the bottom line. And to me, I think it's not helpful in the long run when politicians keep talking about, oh, we need a budget, without saying we need to increase taxes to pay our bills.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that. I think everybody in Springfield is kind of the belief that we're not going to get a big budget deal with revenue in the remainder of this month. That's highly unlikely. That the most we'll probably get is another stopgap budget, which is exactly what Charlie was just talking about. It's the authority to spend money that you don't have. Now, in some cases, you can borrow, but the bond agencies, one of them, S&P during the week, pretty much said that, hey, if we don't have a budget, a real budget by the end of the month, we're going to put Illinois debt into junk. That has all kinds of complications. At a minimum, it makes it more expensive to try to borrow money to pay off some of these bills. At a certain point, and I don't know when that point is, but at a certain point, you literally have to decide between which group of people are going to starve and which group of people are going to go without food on the table, and which group is not going to be able to see the doctor. It's that severe, and it's getting worse. And until they work this out, it's only going to become harder and harder.
On Thursday, there was a hearing that took place. The Illinois House Democrats primarily involved in this, putting this together, in which they had a lot of people who came forward who talked about being victims of the budget impasse and funding for different services being cut. A lot of tears, a lot of anger in that type of hearing. But we've heard this. I don't want to downplay that, but we have heard this for months, actually going into 2 years now, and that hasn't seemed to move the needle at all. Do we, you know, it doesn't seem to me like that's going to make any difference. It's only going to take court orders, most likely, or maybe some uprising of rank and file members of the legislature. But otherwise, I don't know that anything like that's going to help the situation.
Yeah, it certainly hasn't seemed to move the public consciousness. Most people in polls have said that they're not affected by the budget impasse because they don't have somebody who gets mental health services from the state, or they don't have a child who is disabled and needs, you know, 24-hour medical care, helped to be paid for by the state. And so there was, as you said, tears. Republicans and Democrats expressed sympathy. We even heard some outrage. Representative LaShawn Ford, we heard at the top of the show, called for the recall of the governor. But that doesn't really advance, like you said, Sean, it doesn't really advance the discussions in terms of a budget, because the core problem remains that Governor Rauner says he would vote for, or would sign off on, a higher tax rate if the Democrats go along with his agenda, which has varied over the years, but recently has included property tax freeze, changes to the workers' compensation system, things like that. The Democrats say, you know, we've done a little of that, and anymore it would hurt the middle class. We're not going to go along with it. And frankly, the Democrats don't like the idea of tying these things to the budget process anyway. And so that's where we've been for 2.5 years, and that's where it seems like we're going to remain indefinitely, unless there is some sort of mass change in awareness in the state.
The governor,
I don't know.
And the governor did talk this week, I guess, throughout at least the possibility, at least that's the way it was reported, of a special session calling lawmakers back to town to deal with the budget. Does anybody that were on this panel here think that that would solve the issue if they got them all back under the Capitol?
No, that's just another effort by him to look like he's doing something while he's out on the campaign trail. What good does it do to call 118 representatives and 59 senators back if there's nothing for them to vote on?
Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, Crane's Chicago business political reporter Greg Hines, and Brian Mackey of IPR are part of the Illinois Politics Roundtable, moderated by Sean Crawford.
And the baby needs shoes, but I'm busted. Cutting it down to a quarter of a pound, but I'm busted right now. I got a cow that went dry and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that gets bigger each day.
kind of gonna call my baby. I'm gonna go away, cause I'm busted right now. Oh, yes, I am. Well, I went to my brother to ask for a loan, cause I was busted. I hit the bag like a dog without a bone, but I'm busted, I tell ya. My brother said there ain't a thing I can do. My wife and my kids all down with the flu. And I was just thinking about calling on you, cause I'm busted myself.
Who doesn't feel better after hearing Ray Charles? You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM GLT and WGLT.org. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hundreds of folks in McLean County are getting moving to get the upper hand against a terrible disease. Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of the GLT Datebook.
Survivors, caregivers, and everyone else who wants to kick cancer to the curb are gathering at Normal Community High School for the Relay for Life McLean County, coming up June 23rd, starting at 4 p.m., and continuing until 4 p.m. on Saturday, the 24th. The theme for this year's relay is Family Game Night. Kimberly Wright is Relay's community manager. She says the event is the signature fundraiser for the American Red Cross.
The money we raise goes to the American Cancer Society to provide funding for cancer research and all of the programs and services that we provide to cancer patients throughout our nation, and specifically, of course, in our community we are most concerned about here in McLean County.
So the money you raise really goes toward helping those suffering from cancer.
Yes.
And really making progress against the disease.
Yes. Our honored survivor this year is a breast cancer survivor, and she took the drug Herceptin, which was developed by a researcher that was funded by the American Cancer Society. So that's about as close to home as you can get here in our community.
This is a very successful Relay for Life here in McLean County. It's actually one of the most attended and one of the most popular in the world.
Yes, we are actually right now, we are holding the number one spot in the state of Illinois. Last year we were in second place, and we love to have those competitions among all of our relays. It helps keep us moving and helps us stay motivated in raising the funds.
How much do you typically raise?
Last year we raised almost $300,000. Just here in McLean County, our goal this year is to reach 300,000, and we hope to even surpass that.
You have so many interesting things that actually go on during the event. You have an opening ceremony.
Well, this year we are going to have a soft opening at 4 p.m.
Okay.
Then we are going to have an official opening at 6:30, where we will introduce all of our relay teams. We'll introduce how much money we've raised up to that point and how much farther we need to reach our goal, and create an opportunity for us to maybe highlight some of the activities that will be happening in our event. And of course, we will thank our sponsors at that time.
Well, you have interesting things like a survivor lap, and you also have, I think this is very interesting, a caregiver lap. Why is it important to have that?
Yes, well, our caregivers are often overlooked because, you know, being a survivor and going through the battle of cancer, it's difficult for individuals to sometimes think about what's happening to that caregiver. And we, with Relay for Life and all of our volunteers who put on this event, really feel strongly about supporting the caregivers and the survivors. So this year, we've actually decided to have our survivor and caregiver lap together. So the caregivers will be able to walk with their survivors, and those who've lost their loved ones will also be asked to walk during the survivor caregiver lap. And I know a lot of our survivors appreciate the caregiver lap because they know how much their families and loved ones and caregivers have provided for them throughout their journey.
Let's talk about the teams who will be participating in Relay. So, number one, do you really have to have a lot of people on a team? Can you be a team of one?
Well, you really could be a team of one. We have some business and company teams that provide a donation, a sponsorship as a company, and they may just have one person that's registered on their team and contribute that way. We do have teams of every shape and size. We have company teams, we have family teams, girlfriend teams, tough guy teams. We have teams of every kind, and they're of every size.
Do they have fun names?
They really do. We have so many fun names. One of our veteran teams is Imperial Walkers. They are super fun. They spend the entire event dressed in their Star Wars gear.
So they come in costume. They're like cosplayers.
They really do. And they really make it fun at our event.
You know, and that's what I find is so fascinating about this event is the fact that you're taking on this terrible disease and you're taking it on with this attitude of, we're going to have fun and we're going to beat this thing.
Yes, we really want to have a great time at our event. We do have some very moving ceremonies, as you mentioned, but we do have an incredibly fun time at the event. We have bands all night, or all 24 hours, actually, throughout the entire 24-hour event, except for between midnight and 2 a.m., we're going to have a Relay's Got Talent contest.
Uh-huh.
So we are looking for great talent in our community to come on board and help us make that a fun time. But we have bands throughout the entire event. We have a youth zone on Saturday between 10 and 3. We'll kick off the youth zone at 10 o'clock with a lap. And we would like to invite all the heroes in our community, policemen, firefighters, nurses, doctors, to come and walk that 10 o'clock lap. We're going to have a combination hero and youth lap, which will be really fun. Our youth zone has so many different things that you can do. The kids can play in the bounce houses. We'll have four bounce houses and an obstacle course, a 65-foot obstacle course.
Wow.
The Upper Limits Rock Gym is bringing their rock wall. We have a foot dart that's being sponsored by Pizza Ranch.
Foot dart?
It's great. It's a huge dart that you kick a soccer ball at, and it's so much fun. We can't wait to have that. We've never had that before. Knockerball. Have you ever heard of knockerball?
No.
So it's inflatable balls that you climb inside.
Oh, yes, I've seen those, just like those big hamster balls.
Yes, and Thrivent Financial is sponsoring the cost of that. We have some amazing, amazing fun things in our youth zone, and all the kids, while supplies last, of course, will get a free t-shirt with their registration, thanks to Wilcox Electric. They have sponsored that portion as well as the bounce houses. We are looking forward to having a fun event. Oh, and we're going to have a car show at the event on Saturday. And we initially did not plan that in the past and thought that would be a great addition. Friday night, we'll have a health and wellness fair. So we'll have companies out to demonstrate the products and the services that they have available to help people stay well, get well, and live a happy, healthy life.
Are you still going to be doing the luminarias? I know that's been a tradition.
Yes, that is always the most moving portion of our relay event. It'll be at 9 o'clock p.m. We have a wonderful ceremony followed by the opportunity for individuals to light their luminaria if they would like to with the glow sticks. So it's going to be a wonderful time. Luminaria is a way for individuals to honor or congratulate their survivors, honor the loved ones that they've lost, or congratulate those that that have won the battle against cancer. Luminaria bags light the entire track. It's absolutely breathtaking, and it's a wonderful moment, especially for those who've lost their loved ones.
Will there be a closing ceremony, Kimberly?
Yes, at 3 o'clock p.m. on Saturday, after all the fun, we will close at a 3 o'clock ceremony start, and we'll talk about all the money that we've raised. We'll thank our sponsors again and all of our teams. This event is run by volunteers. It's completely driven by the volunteers in our community, planned, implemented, and successfully created by our volunteers. And so we will have an opportunity at closing to thank the volunteers and all the people that raise money for us.
Kimberly, what's the deadline for getting registered for Relay?
The great thing is there is not a deadline. You can register the day of the event. You can show up, say, I want a campsite. If you would like to stay overnight, of course, you don't have to. And we will have a 20 by 20 campsite for every team that registers. If you want to come out as a survivor and enjoy our dinner, complimentary, sponsored by Avanti's. And State Farm, of course, is our presenting sponsor. So they are a part of making this happen as well. We are looking forward to having everyone come out, families, teams, survivors and their caregivers, companies, anyone that wants to come out and help us in the fight against cancer. We need you.
That's Kimberly Wright, Relay for Life's community manager. The event is coming up Friday, June 23rd, starting at 4 p.m. and continuing until 4 p.m. on Saturday, the 24th, out at Normal Community High School. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Learn more about participating in the Relay for Life at their Facebook page. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Country folk rocker Robert Earl Keen plays the Castle Theater Thursday night. Though flying under the mainstream radar for decades, the Texas native has built a rabid cult following since his emergence in the 1980s. GLT's John Norton caught up with Keen to talk about his music, the music industry, and the support he has lent to children's music programs in his home state.
Stand out on Main Street, cross Mr. Blues. My faded leather jacket, my weather broke and shoes. Chill on the wind's blowing, the spring's coming on. I want to myself.
Once you get past Cody Canada's intro, Feeling Good Again is the lead track for the new album by Robert Earl Keen. It's called Live Dinner Reunion. Robert Earl Keen, it's great to have you on. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me on your show, man.
This is a concept album of sorts. You recorded a live album about 20 years ago at a country store in Texas, and you sort of wanted to revisit that album. Why did you want to revisit this concept?
It was kind of a surprise, you know, one of those happy adventures where you did something. The original one I just did on a lark. I liked the way the band sounded. I had my friend Lloyd Maines get a recording truck, like, you know, they did in the old days, and back it up there and fill the stage with carbon monoxide and, you know, get it going. And we recorded this record, and it was really, really popular. It was, at the time, it was the most, you know, it sold more records than anything that Sugar Hill had done for about 10 years. So it was a real big deal. And a lot of, you know, over the years, people always mention it. And so came the 23 Union, and the guy who owns Flores Country Store now is a really good guy. And has changed the venue quite a bit, and I mean, he's updated everything, and it works really well now. And he suggested that, and I thought it was a good idea, so we got together. And so I put together, you know, we did the thing with, we had Reckless Kelly, and we had Cody and The Departed, and then right about a week before it, I thought, you know, I'm going to ask some of my friends. So I asked Lyle and Bruce Robinson and Corey Morrow, and we just had a big time. You know, my friend Duckworth, who is in the original band, came out, and so, you know, we recorded it again and did the same thing, basically.
Yeah, you had a lot more people at this show than the one 20 years ago.
Right, definitely.
I want to ask you about Lyle Lovett. How long have you and Lyle been, known each other, been friends?
Well, what is 2017 to 1976?
Wow, well,
41 years.
Yeah.
41 years.
Why did you want to bring Lyle on board for this album?
Lyle's like my soulmate in the music business. I mean, we not only, you know, met and got along when we were in school and played and hung out all the time when we were in school, but when we got out of school, we played a lot of the same places, did a lot of the same things, and actually, unbeknownst to each other, we both moved up to Nashville, Tennessee in the same week in 1985. So I call him up sometimes when I do stuff and ask him if he's around. If he's around, he's busier than I am, and I'm busy.
What do you say? I'm gonna buy me a pistol as long as I'm tall. Yes, I'm gonna buy me a pistol as long as I'm tall.
The song is Tea for Texas. It's on the new album by Robert Earl Keen called Live Dinner Reunion. Robert Earl Keen is our guest here on GLT Sound Ideas. Joe Ely, another guest. And Joe's a guy that recorded your staple song, The Road Goes On Forever. Were you pretty pleased when his cover came out a few years ago with how he did
it? Yeah, Joe's always, you know, a consummate player and singer. So, you know, anything that Joe does, I used to go see Joe when I lived in Austin, and he always had the best band around, always, you know, and that's because he's a great band leader. When he makes records, he makes really great records. And so, you know, I knew when, like, Joe was talking about doing a song that it was going to be better than my version for sure, so I was really happy. And you know, it's always nice when you're able to get somebody else singing your song so you can show it to your friends or your family and say, see, this song's a real song. It's not just me singing.
Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Ely.
Sherry was a waitress at the only joint in town.
She had a reputation as a girl who got around down Main Street after midnight. A brand new pack of cigs, a fresh one hanging from her lips, a beer between her legs. She'd ride down to the river and meet with all her friends. The road goes on forever and the party never ends.
I want to turn it on a couple of different ways right now. You've lobbied Congress for musicians' rights. How have musicians' rights been altered, especially in the digital age, and what are you arguing that needs to be changed?
Man, don't get me started.
Yeah? It's bad.
You know, the music business has been eviscerated by the internet. That's all there is to it. I mean, it's, look, I accept it because if you look at, I look at it historically. I look at almost everything historically. It's a lot easier to, like, you know, sort of be able to think objectively when you look at things historically. Historically, in the music business, about every 30 years, there's a pretty good shift. There's something that happens, you know, for instance, you know, like in the 50s, the singles. Then, you know, in the 80s, it's the CDs, right? And in between, there was, you know, LPs and that sort of stuff. But, you know, the singles were a big deal. And then, you know, when you went to CDs, it was a big deal. It changed a lot of the ways things were going. It changed the way how many songs you could put on a record and things like that. So then, you know, boom, all of a sudden, you know, 2010, we got, you know, this, you know, full-blown internet net, and CDs are pretty much gone altogether, and everything's in the internet. And the thing is out there is, you know, that other companies, the record companies weren't visionary enough to see this coming down the pike, so they just kind of sat there in the corner and, like, shivered and hoped that somebody would still send them their money. And they didn't, because, you know, Apple took over, Spotify took over, Pandora took over, and all these people, they don't have any history, they don't have any perspective on history, they don't care how much a musician makes, they don't realize that the musicians are always at the bottom of the totem pole. I mean, okay, you can talk about, like, the top tier people, you know, and, you know, mention any of them, whatever. The top tier people are, they're doing fabulous, and it makes it look good, and everybody wants to be one of them. But there's scores, there's hundreds and thousands of people out there that make their money in music, and particularly make their money, you know, like in production or songwriting and stuff like that, and they're not getting paid anymore. Studios have just folded because people make records in their basement and stuff like that.
Well, let me ask you this, Robert.
I'm sure you have an opinion of this.
Well, wondering is what do you tell Congress? What are you arguing needs to change, if anything?
Well, I argue that we have to really pay attention to who's making the music and the people that are out there making the music and how the music is made, because you would not believe how little they know about how a song is created or constructed and how it's put on a demo, how it's handed to an artist, how an artist goes in the studio, plays with some studio musicians, how all of those people all along the line make a living doing that, and all of a sudden somebody, you know, makes this record in their basement and they put it out on Spotify and nobody gets paid. It takes up a seat, you know. It takes up a space. There's no business about, like, thinking that there's not cosmic space in the world. And if one thing takes over, another thing goes away. Mm-hmm. And so you have to remind people that this is still legitimate and people still play.
Robert Earl Keen is our guest. This is GLT's Sound Ideas. You're involved in getting kids involved in music through benefit concerts and other outreach and things. Why is this important to you?
Man, I love classical music. I love classical music because it's like, I don't know, just it's always sounded good to me, and I loved it since I was a little kid, and I can't play it. I can't read a note of music. But my daughter got involved in playing the violin when she was 6 years old. Here in Kerrville, Texas, this is Kerrville, Texas, is 60 miles northwest of San Antonio. Here in Kerrville, Texas, they have a thing called Hill Country Youth Orchestra. They have 100, now that when I started with them 10 years ago, they had about 80 kids. Now they got 140 kids. They have 140 kids that play the violin, the viola, the cello, or the bass, and they learn how to play from note one. You know, they start when they're about 6 years old, but you can come, you can bring any of your kids, any kid can come up, walk up there and sign up, and they'll put them right there and start teaching them how to play. And here is the trick. There are projects like this all over the United States, none of them are free. In Kerrville, Texas, it's free. Any kid that wants to walk up and learn how to play the violin, the viola, the cello, or the bass, and learn how to read music, and learn how to play in a symphony situation, can walk up on Monday evening and sign up, and they get to do this all year round, year after year. In the 10 years that I've been with them, I've watched kids who could barely, you would think, had no musical talent whatsoever, just be barely scratching out Twinkle Twinkle in the Suzuki method, and when they get 13 or 14, all of a sudden, boom, they just explode like some kind of supernova, you know? All of a sudden, they know how to play, and you go, wow, it's amazing. So not only do I love the music, and like I get to be just, you know, get to be a fly on the wall and watch these kids just really grow musically, but I also, you know, I really get to contribute. We play, we do a concert every year. This last year, we did a concert, and they take all the gate. I just play. That's all that I just. That was my deal with them from the beginning. Here, look, okay. I'm going to play. You take all the money. So let's see. We made $74,000 this year. Over the 10 years that we're up to about $700,000 over the 10 years that we've given Hill Country Youth Orchestra. And not only that, we've spread out into the public school system, the Kerrville Independent School District, where we do a thing a month before called "What Does Music Look Like?" in all the art classes and all the public schools here in Kerrville, Texas, draw paintings and drawings of what music looks like to them, and then we, you know, give a pizza party, give them some guitars, you know, give a whole thing, a bunch of, you know, prizes, you know, give a 1, 2, 3, you know, grand prize sort of thing. And so it's spread out into the independent schools. So people even here in this town, they don't all know about Hill Country Youth Orchestra, but because we've spread out into the schools, the awareness is real high.
Well, you talked about kindness and giving back. Boy, that's a definition of it right there. And boy, how about another meaning of the road goes on forever then, too, with you giving back like that? Maybe it's a stretch a little. I just love that song as everybody else does. Robert Earl Keene, thank you. Appreciate talking to you. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Robert Earl Keene speaking with GLT's John Norton. Keep the Castle. Keene plays the Castle Theater Thursday night. You can hear Keene's music during GLT's Acousticity as well as GLT Blues Radio. Get started at WGLT.org. You're listening to Keene and The Road Goes On Forever. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find John Norton's interview at WGLT.org, along with the individual interviews and the full show podcast at our website. Share your thoughts at Facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLTFM. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.